Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Michael Rollman. Hello, Michael.
Hey.
Michael, you're a busy guy, as always. You've got a couple new books out.
Yeah, I am busy. I don't know how I stay so busy. Things just keep happening. We have the Book of Schmaltz out, which we created as an app for the iPad, and then my publisher, a new publisher, wanted to bring it out as a book. So here it is, the Book of Schmaltz, Love Song to Forgotten Fat. And I've long been wanting to fix small errors and recalculate some salt levels in charcuterie and convey information that Brian and I had learned since we published the book in 2005. And so we brought out we're bringing out in September the revised edition of charcuterie. So those are the two big things coming out now.
Okay, charcuterie, the craft of smoking, salting, and curing. A lot of people are probably saying, charcuterie, what's that?
Well, you know, a lot fewer people are saying that today as more and more restaurants put charcuterie boards on their menus. Charcuterie is everything from sliced ham, prosciutto, to sausages, to pâtés, terrines, rillettes, anything that we preserved to eat for later. It means cooked meat, basically. It's a French term for cooked meat. And its original purpose was to preserve what would have been lost before refrigeration, but which we still do now. We make confits, we make salami, we make pâtés and terrines because they taste so good. But originally it was a form of preservation that I was fascinated with.
Now, there are some of these meats that aren't smoked or cooked, aren't there? Don't they just, like, let them sit for a really long time?
Yes, like the famous hams of Parma.
Yeah.
And the Iberian hams. They're salted to slightly dehydrate the meat and therefore reduce opportunity for a spoilage bacteria to grow. And then they're dried further, or rather eliminating bacteria and spoilage. And that's how they do it. So they're basically cooked with salt and thyme, T-I-M-E.
Hmm. Michael Rollman joins us. The Book of Schmaltz. My mother used to like to use the expression schmaltzy. And I never really knew what she was talking about. And then I read your book, The Book of Schmaltz. And a lot of people probably don't know what schmaltz is or was. It's kind of vanished, hasn't it?
It vanished to the point where it's not even in the dictionary. In the dictionary, its only meaning is the one that your mother used, which is which meant overly sentimental. But schmaltz originated, would become this descriptive term, is in fact chicken fat, rendered chicken fat that Ashkenazi Jews used to cook with.
And you've got all these recipes in here for these classic dishes that use schmaltz. And so many of these come from the Jewish tradition, but you created a few of your own, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I did. I'm not Jewish. I'm 100% Goy, though it was fascinating learning about Jewish tradition and how it shaped a culinary tradition. My interest was in the fat itself, not in tradition or maintaining traditions, though that's a perfectly good reason to do something. I was interested in cooking good food, and there were great uses of schmaltz. Schmaltz is it's a flavor. It's flavored by onion. You put onion in it and chicken skin and chicken fat, and you render it all down. You've got this fat that tastes like no other kind of cooking fat. And there are all kinds of new uses beyond chopped liver and matzah balls and kishki and classics from the Jewish tradition. But, you know, I put it to use in Parisian gnocchi pot au chou dough, cream puff dough. I put it in brioche dough. It makes a wonderful, savory brioche. So there's all kinds of things that you can do with schmaltz, and we were sort of in danger of losing it, I think, because no one wanted to cook with it. And certainly Jews felt guilty. I've never talked to a single Jewish person who didn't mention heart attack in the same sentence as schmaltz.
Yeah, okay, well, you've definitely cultivated an interest on my part, and I want to get into some schmaltz. So what should I do? Should I go and buy a bunch of chicken thighs and remove the skin? How am I going to get enough schmaltz to do something?
You can do that. I've done that. Or our family, we roast a chicken pretty much every week. It's one of our staple meals. It's easy, delicious, economical, and goes a long way, certainly if you make stock. So if you roast a chicken regularly, what you can do is there's always globs of fat and excess skin on a chicken. You can put those in the freezer until you have, you know, a cup or two of fat and skin and begin your schmaltz there. Or you can buy bone-in thighs. They usually come 8 to a package, or they do where I live, and take off the skin and reserve the thighs for the best part of the chicken, really, is the thigh. Reserve those for a good braise or a curry or something like that. And then chop up that thigh skin and render it, and then add some onions. And when the skin and the onions are all brown and crispy, strain the oil, and you have your schmaltz and what is called gribenes, which is the skin that's become crispy and chewy with onion, and it's so delicious. Chicken cracklings are great.
And, Michael, I read your blog. Should I really wash that chicken carefully?
Boy, that's causing some stir today, isn't it? Do what you want. Sometimes I wash it, sometimes I won't. I was responding to two new articles that sort of flourished earlier in the week about how you shouldn't wash your chicken. It was bad to wash chicken because bacteria gets spread by by water splattering off the chickens, and that's how you can get all germy. That you don't need to wash your chicken because the oven will kill any germs or bacteria on the chicken, which of course is true. But, you know, I thought it was sort of obvious. Don't people realize that cooking food kills surface bacteria? And therefore, to make people afraid of their chicken is wrong. And it feeds into this sort of crazy hysteria of fearing our food. And I think it's a terrible message to send people, and a confusing one.
There's probably more bacteria on this dollar bill I'm holding.
As a surgeon, a doctor, a medical doctor, noted on Twitter, he actually did a test on chicken and a dollar bill and found more germs on the dollar bill that he was paying for his chicken with.
Michael Ruhlman joins us. He's got a couple of new books out, Charcuterie, The Craft of Salting, Smoking, and Curing with Brian Paulson. And The Book of Schmaltz, Love Song to a Forgotten Fat. And it's hard to talk to you about these books because I want to run out and eat something.
Well, that's good. That's what I want to do. My goal is to inspire people to cook their own food. We have gotten away from this cooking of food. We want everything fast, and we want it now, and we're giving up so much we don't even realize. And I think that's part of the reason for this food infatuation that is sweeping the country. The popularity of food competition shows, food travel shows, food, is because we for many decades lost sight of how important food is. Food is all important. And when our food started making us sick, making us obese, making us diabetic, giving our kids allergies that were unheard of when I was a child, then we start to take food seriously, unfortunately, a little obsessively. And so, again, my goal is to bring common sense to the kitchen, bring a sense of confidence to one's cooking, and a sense of the importance of taking time to prepare a meal and then to share that meal with your friends and family. It's vital to our humanity, not to mention our health. It's good for us. It makes life better. And that's what I have devoted, gosh, the past almost 20 years of my life to understanding and conveying through talk, through video, through books.
When I think about you, I almost always associate you with food. But the last time I had you on the program, it was on a very different subject. It must have been 10 years ago, and you'd written about wooden boats. Did you ever have any idea when you were like 22 years old and you went to go work at the New York Times that you'd end up turning into this food guy?
No, I had no idea whatsoever. This is completely unplanned. So unplanned and so fortuitous, so lucky, that I can only believe that it was somehow, for some reason, foreordained. I did not intend it. I did not seek it out. And yet, it is the only kind of writing that has actually earned me a living, and made our family stable. So no, I had no idea. And for years, I kind of wanted to deny it. I wanted to be a serious, quote-unquote, serious writer. And a serious writer didn't write about food for many decades. There was no such thing. Well, for most of the time, there was no such thing as a food writer. And then in the 50s, it was given over to women. And then it was finally when Craig Claiborne came along. He was the first guy to actually get in there and do it. But still, it was shunted off to, you know, it was the style section. It wasn't hard news. It wasn't really worthy of news. And yet, what happens if we go without food? What happens if we trash our whole food supply? I've never gone more than a day without food, and I certainly would never do so. I couldn't do so comfortably, but I can go many, many weeks without United States foreign policy, for example.
Ouch!
So I am understanding really for the first time over the past few years how important it is for those people to write about food to respect the importance of what they're doing and to take it seriously.
Your Book of Schmaltz has some really great photos. Were these taken by your better half?
They were taken by my better half, my wife Donna. She was a newspaper photographer when I met her, and she got co-opted by marriage into becoming a food photographer, though she's not a foodie and she doesn't like shooting food, which I think is her strength, because she is able to, without emotion or undue drooling over the food, convey information, which is really what I want to do. We show the way food should look in your kitchen. I hate the food magazines and the food pornography that proliferates on the internet, and on magazines and in cookbooks, that set up false expectations of what you can provide. Heavily worked over food. So, you know, bowls of spaghetti where they've arranged almost every strand of the spaghetti by hand. That's not how we cook, and that's not how we should photograph food. We should photograph food the way it ought to look, the way it can look, at its very best in your kitchen, but not where every strand of pasta is manipulated.
So no food stylists were involved, eh?
Regrettably, perhaps, in some cases, no. She's relying on me. I remember, you know, I did all the French Laundry cookbooks, Bouchon and French Laundry and Under Pressure and Bouchon Bakery and Ad Hoc at Home. And the photographer, the wonderful food photographer, Deborah Jones, who just does beautiful stuff, says, hey, these chefs give me such great stuff to work with. How could my photos not be good? And Donna only has me, schlubby me, to style the food. So we stick to informational photography to show people what, you know, what it should look like, how brown it should be. How does the oil, you know, we talk about oil rippling when it's hot enough to put your meat in the pan to saute it, but what does it really look like when it's rippling like that? That's the kind of thing that I want to show.
Well, I see Thomas Keller gave charcuterie a nice blurb. This photo of kreplach, is it kreplach, is that how you pronounce it?
That's correct.
I just want to reach onto the plate and grab this stuff. I've never had kreplach, but now I want to.
Well, because in your experience, you've had pot stickers, haven't you?
Oh, sure.
And you love them. And fried dumplings. Who does not love fried dumplings? I'd like to meet the person who doesn't like fried dumplings. And that's what kreplach are. Kreplach are actually just a way of making use of leftovers. They'd have leftover pot roast from their Sabbath lunch, and they'd shred it up and mix it with some schmaltz, and they'd make a pasta dough, and they'd make basically pot roast ravioli, and they're absolutely delicious.
You've gotten some good guidance here in your book on schmaltz from the writings of a guy named Arthur Schwartz and the assistance of a woman named Joan Nathan. Could you tell our listeners about these people?
These are two of the most prominent Jewish cookbook authors in the country. Joan Nathan writes regularly for the New York Times, has several books out. Arthur Schwartz, Jewish Cooking at Home. Wonderful people. Big spirits and knowledgeable people, and they were my sort of landmark authorities. That I would go to their work. I didn't interview them for the book, but I used their work as a basis for creating the recipes that I do create, for understanding the origins of certain dishes, along with my neighbor Lois Barron, who is the schmaltz queen here in Cleveland Heights. She's the reason why I set about doing this book of schmaltz.
Hmm. Well, the whole process of making Helzel was intriguing to me.
The original Helzel, I think, was to stuff. It was a way to, again, all of the Jewish cuisine is based on economy and making use of everything. So they take these long goose, the necks of geese, and stuff them full of kishki, which is a mixture of matzah and cooked vegetables, and roast it. And so it was a way to use the gooseneck skin in a colorful, delicious, and efficient way. And Lois said her mother would often wrap chicken skin around kishki and roast it. And I thought, wow, what if we took the skin off a chicken, and sort of stuffed that skin, leaving the wings on, to make a cool creation. And Lois gave it her 100% approval and held her put her hand to her chest breathlessly at the photograph that Donna took.
So this was your invention?
I hadn't seen it before, and Lois, I said, what if we did this? And Lois said, yeah, that would work, and so I did it.
Wow. Well, it looks like a flying meal.
It's delicious. Admittedly, it's really not that practical because you want the skin on a chicken, not on a bunch of kishki. But it was a fun experiment and a cool thing to do. And kishki is delicious. And if you've got a big chicken that you would just stew, it's a great way to use that skin.
Michael Ruhlman joins us. We're talking about a couple of new books, the new revised and updated Charcuterie, The Craft of Salting, Smoking, and Curing, and The Book of Schmaltz, Love Song to a Forgotten Fat. And I follow you on Twitter. You're very active on there, and you've got a lot of people who follow you. Are you going on some kind of sabbatical or something? Are you getting ready to go somewhere?
I really ought to. I mean, that really does take a lot of my energy and time that I should probably spend working rather than tweeting. On the other hand, it's one, I love to stay connected to readers. Two, it's a great source of information if I'm looking for, whether I'm looking for a great restaurant in Charleston, South Carolina, or if I'm looking for the type, the breed of hog that they use in England for charcuterie. I find out from Twitter in minutes. It's an astonishing creation.
Wow. So you and Mario are on there tweeting like crazy. I notice Mario is very active on there.
Yeah, Mario seems to like tweeting quite a bit. I agree. Some people like it and take to it, as I do. Other people like Facebook. I don't like Facebook. I don't really understand it. I don't really know how it works. But all these new means of connections are fascinating and fun for me. And, you know, it's very conducive to food talk. And in fact, you know, food is a connecting device. We are most satisfied in our lives when we connect with others, and food does that. And now the internet is doing that in ways that we never dreamed of.
You're from Cleveland, and I always think of Cleveland as a food town because you have so many different ethnic groups that settled there.
That's a good point. It is. For a long time, it was, you know, ethnic groups wanted to assimilate, and so they didn't, you know, broadcast their culinary heritages. But now, in this new age of food appreciation, they really do. So, you know, so we appreciate and rejoice in pierogies, and we rejoice in our sausages here. And it's a big meat and potatoes Eastern European culture in Cleveland, and we love that.
Your new book, The Book of Schmaltz, is published by Little Brown. I get the sense from comments you made that this is a new imprint for you. How did this book morph from being an app to a book? What was the process?
Well, for a while, my wife Donna and I were thinking, why do we even need a publisher these days? Let's just publish ourselves. And I came up with this idea to write about this obscure fat, chicken's fat, and we thought no publisher's really going to be interested. And let's self-publish this as an experiment and see how it goes. So I wrote it, we photographed it, we had the recipes tested, we hired a graphic designer, we hired a digital person to help us get it digitized. And just before we published it, I was making a book deal with Little Brown, a traditional publisher, a venerable and traditional publisher. And we showed them the PDF of Schmaltz, and they said, we want this too. I said, well, you can't have it. I'm publishing it. He says, well, we want to publish it in book form. I said, okay, go ahead. I don't want to publish it in book form. That's too hard for me. They said, okay, but you can't publish it digitally. And I said, well, then the deal's off because this is an experiment and it's all ready to go. We've already done all the work and I'm putting it up. And they said, okay, we'll buy it anyway. Huh? And so a year later it came out in hardcover a couple weeks ago.
So you were still on the honeymoon when you made that deal?
Yes, we were. And the honeymoon has been going on and on. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, I'm really happy with Little Brown. They've been absolutely wonderful to work with, and I love them.
So is this the first book that you've had on Little Brown?
This is the first book with Little Brown. That's correct. And the next one will be about the miracle that is the egg. It's going to be about cooking with eggs and how, if you know everything there is to know about cooking with eggs, you increase your skills as a cook tenfold.
Wow. So
yes.
Where do you get your eggs? Do you have somebody who has their own chickens that gives you eggs? You get those really good green Mayakama eggs? Where do you get your eggs?
I get some eggs from Chef's Widow on Twitter, who lives around the corner, the wife of Jonathan Sawyer, a chef in town. When they have abundant eggs, as they do now, we have wonderful farmers markets here throughout the summer. And when I need eggs and I don't have access to farm fresh eggs, I get them at the grocery store.
And you're okay with that?
Yes, you know, it's what most people, it's what's available to most people. There's not a huge difference. I prefer fresh eggs that I know and that I know where they came from and who raised the chickens and how they were handled. But, you know, eggs are eggs.
Uh-huh.
I don't think there's it's not a huge difference, but I think you will get better, more nutritious eggs, or it makes sense that you would, from chickens that are allowed to eat bugs and weeds and stuff, as opposed to being fed commercial or other kinds of grain.
We call them happy chickens, Michael.
Happy chicken is a good chicken.
That's right. I have a neighbor just down the road. I live out in the country, and she calls me whenever she gets another dozen eggs. She calls me, and I go down there and get them fresh.
You are a lucky man.
From
don't
her
lose
hens.
That contact.
I tell you, in the winter, when the hens are kind of relaxing and not really laying too many,
that's right.
I'm her only customer.
Well, you're lucky to have those winter eggs, because they really do. People don't understand that chicken is a seasonal animal too. They slow down in the winter, and there are fewer chickens born. So restaurants that rely on normal farms for chickens can't always serve chickens throughout the winter, and we need to understand that.
Well, we have to cultivate our food connections and try to get that really good food, right?
That is absolutely right.
So do you spend a lot of time doing that, just to get the stuff that you need? Do you have a whole network of people that give you your charcuterie and what have you?
There are a number of farmers for meat and for eggs that I do rely on. But again, you know, I'm like everybody else. I'm really busy. I travel a lot. I rely on the grocery store for most of my food. And I go to an independent family-run grocery store, but it's still buying a lot of meat that is probably not ethically handled. It's something that I grapple with. It's not an easy choice. But I think there are more and more choices, and I try to make use of them as much as I can by ordering the meat from Aaron Miller or Scott Bainline. They both grow great chickens and pork and beef. Getting my eggs from farmers and getting my vegetables from local farmers, or buying from grocery stores, who are more and more likely to be purchasing from local farms because it's a marketing tool, and in a good way. So there's all kinds of options, and we as consumers need to be aware of them, and we as consumers need to be aware that when we put a dollar down to pay for something, we're voting for more of it. Mm. So when you buy crap, you're asking for more of it. When you buy the good stuff, you're asking for more of it. So buy the good stuff.
We've been talking to Michael Ruhlman. He's got a couple of new books out. Charcuterie, The Craft of Salting, Smoking, and Curing is just out in a new revised and updated edition with Brian Polson. And The Book of Schmaltz, Love Song to a Forgotten Fat. And if you read this book, you're going to be making your own schmaltz. You won't be able to help yourself. And that is my big goal this winter. And another thing I want to do this winter is I want to leave my stock out on the stove just to see if I can get away with it.
You can, but always the next day, bring it to a simmer for a good 5 to 10 minutes. That's important, because there will be bacteria in there. There's bacteria everywhere. And we want to make sure that any spoilage bacteria is dispatched. And so you must, if you do leave it out overnight, and it's cool enough, it's perfectly fine as far as I'm concerned. I do it all the time and I've never had any problems with it, though there are scientists who will say, ooh, you're playing with fire there. Do what you feel comfortable with. Know what you are doing. Again, you can do that as long as you have that kill step in your process.
Well, Michael, I know you got to run. I just got one more quick question. What's your target date for publishing the egg book?
The egg book is due for, I'm going over the galleys right now, and the egg book is due out in April.
Wow. Well, we'll be watching for that in the spring, and we really appreciate your time today.
Pleasure talking with you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook. My guest has been Michael Ruhlman. The last time we had Sue Grafton on the program was about a dozen years ago, and she was midway through the process of writing her best-selling series featuring private detective Kinsey Millhone. She's following the alphabet, and she's almost come to the end of it. Her new book is W is for Wasted, the 23rd book in the series. 3 left to go. We'll be talking to Sue Grafton next week. And maybe get a clue about those final 3 books. Coming up in the Book Nook, Sue Grafton returns after a dozen-year hiatus, and we're very happy to welcome her back to the Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.